forest waiting for the salt crossing of the Rhine. Mm-hmm. I remember an instant where the British Naffy came up to see the pioneers and give them tea wagon. And did I tell you this story?
No. It just strikes me funny. Naffy with tea in another
hole. So anyway, they came up and they, of course, the pioneers started lining for tea with their mugs. And a couple of Canadians lined up too, so the Naffy guy served these two or three pioneers and they wouldn't serve the Canadians. So these British pioneers said, "You weren't serve our friends? You weren't are you not going to serve our friends?" And they said, "No." So they poured their tea on the ground and walked off. We're not going to drink any of that. This poor guy came in to see me and he said, "What am I going to do? I don't have enough tea for everybody. I'm really only meant to do it for British." So I said, "Well, I'll tell you a story. Quite a while ago, the Canadians were producing chocolate bars and that sort of stuff, and they wouldn't give it to the British, so I kicked them out of my unit and said, you bring back all chocolate bars to everybody in this unit, and they're part of it." Mm-hmm. And so we won the fight, and I guess they remembered it, so they were going to work for their buddies, the Canadians. Anyway.
Well, sir, would Naffy be, they'd all be civilians, wouldn't they?
Yeah. Yes, they like artillery service. It might be, Salvation Army and this sort of stuff doing things, but just, they were a civilian organization, yes.
Yeah.
They had their rules. Their rations were that way. I said, go ahead and serve your tea until it's finished, and then fine, we'll say thank you very much. Nobody's going to complain that there's no more tea. Mm-hmm. And so they did. They didn't care who took it. And we had the pioneers were very good. We had a hell of a time getting rid of them. They didn't want to go. They wanted to come back to Canada with us.
Well, I guess there's no problems with them, you know, in terms of pay, because you always hear the great arguments about how the British were poorly paid in comparison to the Canadians and the Americans.
Yeah, they were.
But I guess you didn't have any place to spend the money, so
no.
Gambling, I guess, would have been the only place.
Yes, yes, there was a lot of that, but again, we didn't have very many places where we do it. For instance, a lot of people had, you could do it in a tank or on the back of a vehicle. We could do it in the back of a vehicle. I'm sure it did happen, too. But generally speaking, they were too busy. There wasn't much of it.
Gambling takes energy and a lot of excess time, and I guess when you're busy, you don't have that.
That's right. Yeah. Well, not only that, most of our work was at night. And we'd work...
Police. The school's out, I suppose.
I suppose they were just... too busy. I'm not sure, but there probably was some gambling. In fact, I'm sure there was, but not any very serious problem at all.
You say most of your work was done at night.
Mm-hmm.
Why was this? Because most of the movement would go on during the day, so it had
That's
to be
right.
done for them.
If you were doing any mine clearing, it was probably an observed area, you might try to do it at night. Mm-hmm. Same thing with bridges. You build them at night because you weren't going to get so many people potting at you.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, you very often had these things had to be ready for an assault at first light. And I remember one time putting mine marking lights, they were little lights like the guidance things you see in Europe along the side of a road, a little more sophisticated than that, on both sides of a bank, a railroad bank, that was flooded with water. And everybody had been so busy that my sergeant major and I did it. We were the only two who didn't have an assigned job, walking the water up to this, putting these things in, because the tanks would be out and up to 3 or 4 feet of water. Mm-hmm. So they didn't want to be able to slide off to bank. Anyway,
where are we talking about now? What area?
This is in the flooded area, getting towards the crossing of the Rhine.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. I forgot which side of the Rhine it was, but it was certainly, I think it was when they were trying to get the tanks around on the flank. Flank movement or something, bring them in undetected at night. Anyway, tanks wouldn't go on if we did mark it. But it's pretty eerie going through a small, completely isolated, deserted station, knowing damn well you better not go in that station because there's probably a lot of booby traps in the station. But they were not along the track. Got right on through the bloody station. I think my sergeant major and my quartermaster and I did that.
Well, why did you three do it?
Because nobody else did it. Everybody else was working, building a bridge or something.
It would seem to me that would be rather foolhardy in some respects, because if something happened to you three, and chances are if something had gone up, you would all have gone up. You know, three most important people in the company are gone.
No, that's debatable. I think they've got a 2IC, and each of the troops have got a CO and sergeants and this sort of. No, we were not that.
But who were the people under you? Were they very good?
Yes, very good. They were about half the number of officers that they have in the same units now. We had a lieutenant in charge of each of the squadrons. A fellow named Alan McCauley, and oh gosh, I can see the other. Then in the headquarters, we had my 2IC was a fellow named first Finlayson, and then later. Doesn't matter. Anyway, he didn't come to pretty well in the end. And then Beach, Lieutenant Beach, and then Lieutenant Carter in headquarters. So we had seven officers, and probably seven, six, ten sergeants, sergeant major, and corps master sergeant, and a whole bunch of corporals, of course, mm-hmm. and lance sergeants, but six lance sergeants.
How were the officers? Were they all trained engineers?
Mm. Well, they weren't necessarily qualified engineers. A few of them had gone through things like RMC and hadn't yet got their engineering qualifications, but they were all qualified in military engineering. One of them was definitely commissioned from the ranks. Two of them, I think, were commissioned from the ranks. Was not and may never have been qualified as an engineer. That didn't matter. Perfectly satisfactory for combat engineering. Mm. In fact, much better than some of the qualified engineers. Generally speaking, you don't need a fully qualified engineer in a field squadron very often. You should have one or two available. Normally, we always consider there should be the CO and at least one or two others. But very often, you have a lot more than that.
So that if you were hit, your 2IC would have been perfectly capable of continuing
yes.
on?
Mm-hmm. He might not stay very long, but he would continue on until our boss reassigned him or got somebody else in.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I replaced a guy who was hit and killed. I think it must have been close to the Seine area. Anyway, McCallum.
Had he been killed in the line of...
Yeah. I think he was blown up in a mine or something. I don't know exactly.
Was he well liked and well respected by the
men? Yes, he
was. Did that impair your ability to?
No. I knew some of them anyway, because it was the breakup of the unit I went overseas with. The 4th Battalion was broken up into three field squadrons and a few part squadrons, and these were the names. They're not the same ones I was with. I was with what was called A Company in 4th Battalion, and that formed the 29th Field Squadron,
mm-hmm.
or Field Company. And the 31st was the old C Company of the 4th Battalion. So I there weren't very many left.
Probably some senior NCOs.
Yeah, some of the senior NCOs.
Well, were you the only permanent force officer or permanent force member of the company? I mean, thinking of it, senior NCOs here as well.
Well, Beach stayed in. He was a lieutenant, came straight from RMC. I don't know whether he recognizes it for the current force officer then or not, but he did become a current force officer after. So we didn't look at it that way. We were just for assigned to a job in war commissions, but there was no difference in the looks or your uniform or your any of your designations.
But it seems to me those who
had different numbers pre-war. Before the war, we didn't have any numbers at all, and then when the war started and they had regimental numbers, they gave all the regular force a ZP. And that P was the permanent force. Now, some people getting a commission during the war might have been designated as permanent force, although in effect were just the same as the others, but they just come in after the war started.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure whether Beach was one of them or not.
Were they, for the most part, younger people?
Even the people of my unit?
Mm-hmm.
The officers mostly younger than I was. There was one was a little older. 2IC was older, I think. Some of the other ranks were, quite a lot of the other ranks were a lot older.
We've got experienced people, and as well, you're not the cutting edge. you're just behind the cutting edge.
Mm.
So I suppose the higher-ups would decide that, well, you don't need the 20-year-olds necessarily amongst the engineers.
Is that a valid point? In selecting for engineers, they have had a slightly different standard. Generally speaking, you had a battle, a physical requirement, the same as infantry.
Mm-hmm.
But then they would say, okay, the people with glasses may. So that was, and then they would have, but only some types of glasses of eye impairment.
You mean people who had glasses couldn't have been in the front lines fighting?
Yeah, they could in some cases, but not all. For instance, as an example, they can't be a pilot. They can be a navigator in the Air Force, they can't be a pilot. There are things of this sort. It's very narrow, and in many cases, somewhat unjustified, because halfway along the ride, somebody starts wearing glasses and you don't kick and load. So there were not too many people wearing glasses in the infantry.
Mm-hmm.
Just too damn much extra. Well, there were certainly some as they got more senior. That's reading glasses only, that sort of thing. But anyway, our standards were a little bit different in that we generally required a slightly higher education standard. I'm talking about the other end.
Mm-hmm.
The infantry like grade 8 minimum, we like grade 10 minimum. I didn't know we'd get it.
Is there really a difference, a discernible difference between grade 8 minimum and grade 10 minimum?
Generally speaking, if you've got, we say we like grade 10 minimum, we want them to be able to go to grade 12.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a lot of our trades now, I'm talking more peacetime than I was in wartime, because it isn't nearly as specific in wartime. In peacetime, a lot of our trades almost require grade 12 to be able to go ahead, get ahead of it.
Some of the mathematics, I think, would be
Craftsmen, some of the mathematical things. Some of the formative, the mechanist foreman, and the formative works, and the electricians, and things of this sort. They would have to have enough mathematics to. And now, you don't need grade 12 in everything, of course, but you need you to be able to get there, put that way.
Mm-hmm.
I think the infantry, and I'm not trying to be rude to them, don't want them too bright.
You don't want soldiers to think, right?
Well, no, I think they want them to think, but they don't want them to think too much.
Yeah.
That's sounds like a cynical thing, but it's true. You know, most of the engineers in wartime were they never did two jobs the same.
Mm-hmm.
Almost every time, even the bridge being built isn't the same as the last one you did. Sure, it goes together the same way, but
the conditions are
quite different. The bank seats and how you're going to get it there and how you're going to push it out or whatever it may be is always different.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to do a floating one, sometimes the river is very very swift and sometimes it isn't. And sometimes it isn't just like a pond. And very often you've got all sorts of swamps to get through before you get there, where the bridge could be put on this or that. Most of the work is in that way, rather than the mechanical putting it together. That's why we could use the pioneers doing quite a lot of bridging activity. They could put things together very easily after it got trained.
Mm-hmm.
Put a few sappers in charge of them.
And there's no problem.
Yeah.
Well, tell me, what you as a permanent force officer would have been schooled to a degree of discipline. Now, did you find that the discipline was a problem amongst a unit like this? Was it, say, a less military than an infantry company?
No, I don't think it was that military. Working on their own and earning their own living, plumber, bricklayer, blacksmith. So they don't need an awful lot of direction and discipline. They need guidance and little leadership. And as such, they're really very easy to do. Much easier than an infantryman who's going to have to be driven into it in some cases.
Mm-hmm. So what did you see your main role as, administrator and almost father figure, if you like to use that phrase, because
you had to
of your
do
guidance?
Both, you had to do both of those, of course, yes. But no, I think you were more a leader.
Mm-hmm. Would you lead by example, or would it be
partly? Partly, yeah. You have to. That's one of the reasons I did that thing with the sergeant major. Why call some poor bugger out who had damn little sleep and do it when it could easily be done by me and somebody else? We thought we didn't even know how to order somebody to do it, because until we got there, how do we know?
Well,
it took a couple of hours. It would have taken half of that to be able to get somebody up and tell them to do it. So we.
Well, it strikes me that it would be even harder to lead in a company like that if you've got so many people who are independently minded. You've really got to be strong as a leader, as opposed to someone in an infantry company who could simply order. If you're doing it by example, you've really got to show these people something.
There's a point in that. But in fact, all these tradesmen in civil life are used to working with other tradesmen, because a plumber doesn't build a house alone.
Yeah.
He's got to work with the other people, and they're used to working with those people. I would say that because they were able to work without supervision, without very much supervision,
mm-hmm.
and to work well with other people, they were in duck soup, truthfully.
They weren't unionized employees before the war, then?
No. Well, even unionized employees know damn well they've got to work together with other people.
Mm-hmm.
Construction trades are really rather interesting. Much more interesting these days.
Very interesting. Have you heard anything about Expo today? Or?
No.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what Bennett and the rest cook up.
Well, this morning, apparently the Roche said that he thought that they were going to come to some common ground.
Well, I've heard that by the weekend it's going to be signed, sealed, and hopefully delivered.
Well, my thoughts on the whole thing is that it was a hell of a time to be worrying about this now. We should have done this about 3 years ago, if indeed some rules are required, and I guess they were. In fact, I'm sure they are. That should have been spelled out a long time ago. Not let it get to a crisis before you take action.
Yeah. Well, I think that the election precipitated action, and the action was rather late in the game. And now they're feeling the results of the late action all the way around.
Oh, yeah.
Not simply in the trade unions.
Yes, all the way around. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, let's get back to World War II instead of World War III or BC one or whatever. So, did you continue with this unit right to the end of the war?
Yes.
Okay, so I think we're about to discuss the Rhine crossings. So the winter's over.
Yeah.
How quickly did the weather take to get to a manageable state where you could actually start planning?
Well, the most problem we had was this terrible flooding. Everything was so badly flooded that you had to stay on roads.
Even this area of Germany. I've heard that was the case in Walcheren and in the Scheldt area.
That's right. Well, getting to the Rhine, I'm talking about, really.
Mm-hmm.
In the Rhine itself, it wasn't too bad. No, in the Reichswald forest, it was fairly dry. But then that seemed to be up, and then you go down off towards the Rhine. But I've forgotten how far it is away. But we actually, a large part of the Canadian Army, I guess, sat around in the Reichswald after having gone through what normally is the Siegfried Line, which wasn't really there at all.
That's a propaganda gimmick as much as anything else, I think.
There were a lot of stuff there, but not a lot in this particular area. There were a hell of a lot of mines, and this is when a lot of people went damn near bananas trying to clear roads. And there wasn't a lot of opposition. There was lots of opposition, but there wasn't a lot of opposition from the air and that sort of stuff. I don't remember the weather being... In fact, I think as we crossed, it was a day like this, a nice, bright,
crisp day.
We built the second tier of bridges. There was an assault bridge went across, and a lot of assault ferries and boats and this sort of stuff, and the floating tanks and everything else got across. And it seemed to me we were near Cleve. And then we had to build a bridge. I think we were building the first 40-ton bridge. If I remember right, it was 1,870 feet long. And I think I got a picture of it.
Is that some sort of record for that kind of bridge?
It was the biggest bridge on the Rhine, yeah. And for that reason, it was taken down not too long after that and replaced by several shorter ones. we built it, my company, and I think all of the core troops companies were working on it.
Would you have men on either side and you would be building inward toward the center, or?
No, you built it all from this side, but because you know, how are you going to get the equipment over there? You build it all from one side. You take the landing bay over and land it, and then you have hope like hell. These things are about a minimum of 20 feet, and they can go up a bit, but you've got to have a distinct 10-foot thing, or otherwise the bloody thing won't fit, and the last raft goes into the bridge, it's got to fit.
Or see the chainsaws out.
Well, you pull the hell. Every now and again there's a very bad moment, even on a short bridge, worrying about that sort of thing. But when you have that long one, it's really dicey. They always have about, I think 10% extra rafts in case something goes wrong, because, you know, they have, one will sink or get damaged by fire or something, and you just take it out of bridge and put another one in. A little dicey if the end ones do, because the end ones are special, that they have long rafts, because it's got to go up and down as the water goes up and down. Although that's not tidal in that area, the flood thing is quite markedly different.
And how were the currents on that river?
Quite high, as I remember. They were about 6 knots or something like that.
And how would that affect the progress of the bridge?
If you're not careful, the bridge will look like this. You spend a lot of time throwing out decent anchors and making sure that it stays fairly up, a little uphill, so you don't let it back down again. That was a mighty good bridge, I would say.
How long did it stay in commission before it was replaced?
I don't know. We didn't take it down, somebody else did. I would think probably about a couple of weeks or 3 weeks. I don't know. I really don't know.
So this is a 40 tenner, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Let me ask you something rather off again, but you've got a tank on, say, and he's crossing. How much width did the bridge have? Like, would he be very narrow?
He didn't have a lot of room, but it wasn't very difficult, because the sides of the thing are up about 5 feet, and he can see it pretty well. And if there's really any problem, you put lights on it. In fact, I think they did put lights on it for night travel, but... About a foot or a foot and a half on each side. Not a very difficult thing. There's a wheel strip inside that to stop you from running off into the edge.
But if you're a 40-ton tank and you hit that edge...
A 40-ton tank would ruin it,
yeah.
But generally speaking, a tank isn't too bad. It goes pretty straight, and the bloody wheel vehicles that spend more time taking control of that thing. Tanks have to be about, I think they have to be 50 feet apart or something, or a little more than that perhaps, you know, 100 feet apart.
So conceivably on that 1,800 foot bridge you could have a lot of tanks crossing it at once.
Yeah, you might have 18.
Indeed.
I don't think you would, because they don't, there's a tendency if you get to the end to charge up the ramp, and this changing of gears is a bit rough on some of the things. I don't know. I didn't see them fully being used. But as soon as we did that, we moved on somewhere else and started doing something else.
Mm-hmm.
We always watched the first one or two things go across and then bust off.
And you went right into Germany, I think.
Well, you were in Germany then.
Mm-hmm. So you continued on into Germany.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We went... We went up the... Leer and the Weser. The Weser River comes in from, and it divides Holland and Germany, but in fact it's well inside Germany. But generally speaking, it runs parallel.
It's a geographical boundary, at least, anyway.
It is a geographical boundary, but it's not the national boundary, because Germany is a bit over it. Anyway, we went on to. Near the Weser, and did several bridging tasks there. And then, just before the end of the war, we built a bridge on the Weser, floated it down the Vaser and around the corner on the Lear, up the Lear, and put it together. About, I guess it must have been about 30 miles difference.
And what was the reason for that?
We didn't own the real estate.
So you floated it past the occupied?
Well, no, it wasn't. It was, by that time, it was taken, but it was not too certain that we were going to own it completely.
Mm-hmm.
So we floated up at night. I suppose it was 10 miles or something. The two landing bays were 190 feet each. I think they weighed 90 tons apiece. And then all the others were, say, 30 feet, 30 to 40 feet. You can make the rafts 30, 40, or 10, well, 20, 30, 40. I think they were 40. I'm not quite sure, but anyway, they were not very big. And they were relatively simple. And we put motors on them and we pulled them up.
Did you find that the workload increased or decreased as the war progressed? I'm thinking of the late stage while you're in Germany.
It increased, because as you were going faster, things got more confusing and more work to be done. Particularly roads were just absolutely completely disappeared. We spent quite a time trying to put roads back together again, just blowing down houses and spraying them on the road, really.
Yeah.
We had an order at one stage just to no longer to use ecclesiastical rubble. In other words, we're not allowed to blow down churches anymore. And yet they were the easiest because there were no bits and pieces of plaster and that sort of stuff in. But
so you blow the houses,
bulldoze the stuff in onto the road.
I guess the German people really liked the Canadians.
Not much. Very often you had to do that anyway, or some of them, because they were, if you're having tanks coming through these corners, you'd have to blow down a couple on the corners and get them around.
Yeah.
And I remember one time when the Germans sniped at some of the troops, in fact killed a couple, one of the SEAL, and they burned the whole damn town down.
Canadians did.
Yeah. But it was a sort of retaliatory sort of thing. But it was also kind of useful. We needed all that rubble to put on the damn road. we were following along behind these naughty people who did this. We were delighted when we came there because here was all sorts of rubble that had all the wood burned out of it. So, anyway, yeah, it wasn't very nice, but it was. Your thing was you had to get on.
Yeah.
You would sometimes open a quarry if there was any nearby.
But it's the case
one of the hard, one of the distinct things you had to do is to keep track of what was available.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of the engineer intelligence standard things was to report through all the things you went by. You went by a lumber yard, you'd report it. And the rear army kept a sort of list of what everything was. We always would make corduroy roads quite frequently because there wasn't anything else. Cut down trees, or very often take an awful lot of stuff out of a lumber yard and lay it out and put it down on the road.
But did you find at this time, were the Germans moving so quickly that they were leaving more behind than they were before?
Yes. Well, this was civilian stuff, usually, anyway. Yeah, I guess they did. But didn't get an awful lot of German equipment. Yeah, I guess they did.
Well, from what I've read of the Germans and their thoroughness, especially in Russia and the early part of the French campaign, that anything left behind, I mean, everything has a military significance. So if it's lumber, if they had the chance, it would have been burned or blown up or whatever.
As they started going a little faster, they left more equipment.
Yeah.
But I guess in Germany they didn't particularly want to have too much damage. It's hard to say.
If that was the case, they would have surrendered before the Russians hit Berlin or you folks hit the Rhine.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. But you're dealing with Hitler and that wasn't exactly a case of Russian clout. What I wanted to ask you about were the people that you met. Now, you had been through French people, Belgians and Dutch, and the Germans. Was there a lot of animosity between the German citizens or civilians and the invading Canadian, British, American soldiers? Or did you have time really to...
No. You mean between, say, the Dutch and the Germans? Or?
No, the Canadians and the Dutch, the Canadians and the Belgians, and the Canadians and the Germans specifically.
The Dutch particularly like the Canadians and were very good. Dutch were funny people. They weren't very used to doing things very much, so they were almost lethargic in some cases. And they get going, they were great.
Mm-hmm.
The Belgians were solid, sullen, really, in a way, although some of them were very nice, and some of them, we didn't see a lot of them, we weren't in Belgium very long.
Mm-hmm.
The French were, particularly North French, were pretty sullen. They'd had a pretty tough time, and they'd seen wars go back and forth and back and forth, but then they went back to work and cleaned up their stuff, and that's it. But the Dutch seemed to be so stunned that they sometimes wondered whether they were really going to get things up on their own or not, but then they were great when they did. In some cases the Germans were quite good, in some areas they were just horrible, and you know, there was one place where I was, when Middletown, we were the only troops that had been in, and the Burgermeister got me and tried to get me to cut the hair off two women. No way, I'll watch if you want, but I'm not going to enter that sort of stuff. But there's some of these collaborators, they were a little rough with me. Was just give him a complete pig shape.
Have
quite a ceremony doing it too.
A Burgermeister who probably collaborated in his own right, in his own way, rounded up two women who perhaps were lovers of some German soldier.
That's right. Yeah. I don't know. Of course, the theory is that the Burgermeister wasn't collaborating, but whether he was or not, I don't know. But obviously, this was not the sort of thing we should get into. And two or three places where you'd have to watch some of this activity going on. It wasn't very pleasant.
Could you intercede, or was it that you were not allowed to, or supposed to, or thought it best not to?
I don't think anybody ever thought that we'd be asked to do these sorts of things. Nobody told me I shouldn't. I would then, if I would.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose some Canadians did, but I don't think so. I mean, it's not the sort of thing that Canadians take great joy in doing. vindictiveness. I suppose they had some sort of a kangaroo court that accused these women, and who knows? And I suppose there must have men were just as bad as they.
It's one of the less attractive aspects of war.
Yes.
What happens after it's over?
Yes. Well, this funny little town. As a matter of fact, I think we were the first ones in there, and it was a little place that had a lot of oysters, and oyster beds. And as we came in, they gave us barrels of oysters. So we really had ourselves a good party in that way. And
lots of jokes about aphrodisiacs. That sort of
that's
thing.
Right. Needed these a lot. Anyway, I remember that my boss's boss, chief engineer of the Corps, coming in and hearing about this and saying, get me some oysters. And I think they expected me to get them free, so I bought some from them for cigarettes and then sent them up to Brigadier Black with a bill for 200 cigarettes. It mattered hell. Bloody AMS gets everything. Why the hell shouldn't you pay for it? there was one funny place. I didn't experience it myself. In between Arnhem and Nijmegen, there was a little railway station in between. And right on this railway station, there was a train with quite a number of big casks of wine. On the Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, the Germans used it, and on Tuesdays, Thursdays, Saturdays, and Sundays, the Canadians used it. Nobody ever broke any either. And there were more than one place where the Canadians or the British were using the same supply depot as the Germans. That happened quite frequently. Not frequently, but occasionally.
Well, it stands to reason. Sure. They're located in strategic places.
Sure.
And no doubt soldiers were staying in barracks that had once been German or had been German few days before.
Yes, lots of times.
And to further point even farther, lots of the whorehouses in France and Holland and all the rest of it had been German at one point, and they were British or Canadian couple days later.
We didn't see very much of towns. We were in towns occasionally, but not very often. We usually were in small villages outside. I remember when we took over a small school thing in the outside of, well outside of Brussels, we were waiting to do something out there. The Burgermeister came in and wanted know where we live, the officers, and they right there, where the men live, right there. Oh, it is a marvelous army.
Why was that? Why did you find yourself not in the towns? Faster to stay outside of them?
Well, we had a lot of vehicles. You'd look for a school or something of this sort that had a yard you put your vehicles in, and that the towns you didn't have anywhere to put your vehicles in, so that you get robbed blind if you do it.
Don't forget that most of these small towns have been planned or built 200 years ago, and in those days they didn't have cars and whatnot, did they?
No, most troops didn't stay in the big towns. Sure, there were some did, and I know that later on we used German barracks and that sort of stuff. But they were the place to put your vehicles in.
Let me ask you this, where did you find yourself on VE Day? And what were you doing?
VE Day? I don't remember. I really don't remember.
But when did you first hear that the war was over?
I guess it was just after we that bridge floated around down one river and up the other, down the Lear. Must have been just after the Lear, because I think that was the last sort of push. And then just after that, we went back to where we had left all of our administrative stuff on the way there. And I think we were just in there when it happened. I'm not sure. And we cantered across to Oldenburg, with one brief stop in a place called Friesoys, I think it was. Anyway, it was around that time, I think. So we were in Germany just having done a major bridge thing, I think. Anyway, the Canadian Army was then positioned along the thing to make sure that the German north of the in Wilhelmshaven and that sort of area stayed there, and we used the troops quite often for work.
Did you ever? I guess there were no concentration camps in your area. Well, from what I've heard of some of the British Army types who got into the camps, engineers were called in to deal with the remnants, what was left.
Thank God. there were some small camps we saw a little later in the occupation force,
but the big ones were in Poland and in the east somewhere.
Well, no, there were some weren't too far away from Hamburg, I gather. And there were some camps in Holland for that matter, but I don't remember seeing any.
Did your job end effectively then when the war did? Engineers weren't sent home, but
no. We got busier than ever trying to keep all these bloody generals happy. They would set up AMS, and I remember completely decorating a house and new plumbing and all sorts of fancy bloody electrical stuff and white gravel everywhere. Anyway, we built a wharf for their fruiting around in boats on Vazmishnan. And then we had to put on the far end of the lake a sign, blue diamond sign, and illuminated so that they sit on their wharf and see it. And that was about 3 miles away, the biggest bloody sign I've ever seen. Anyway, huge bloody thing.
What did the sign say?
Just the blue diamond. That was the tax sign of Second Corps. Anyway, we did that, the Corps commander would sit there and look at it. We ruined, we blacked out a whole section of Germany by using all the electricity we needed to damn thing. We weren't very pleased with it, and I very nearly got an adverse report for being rude to generals about this sort of stuff. Anyway,
it was their fault, wasn't it?
Well, don't they want to have white paths to their caravan? That was fine. They were in a lovely sort of park area. I suppose this old hotel had been a sort of a spa. In fact, I'm sure it had a spa.
Mm-hmm.
And they took the main house and made that into their mess. And had all their caravans around in the orchard. And then there had another unit, an engineer unit, who looking after all their boats and fishing activities and sailing activities. They've got to buy all the sailboats they could find in Germany and a yacht club. Oh.
I guess
we were busy as hell.
Keeping them happy. You didn't take kindly to this, I take it.
I didn't like it at all. No. We normally you take turns to be the core maintenance company, core headquarters maintenance company, and I'd never been it. I got it just as the war ended,
and you got stuck with it.
And stuck with some of the most awful bloody things. Well, you know, some of them, and if they're going to move frequently, there are a lot of things to be done to set up the support stuff for a core headquarters. It's quite a big organization, maybe 500 people in here. Anyway, including quite a lot of quite senior people, and I unfortunately fell heir to it just as the war ended. Everybody had their ideas of what they wanted to do, how comfortable they wanted to be. I remember even painting panels, six different kinds, on the walls, where the general would say which the hell color he wanted in the mess. And they changed their minds so often. And we finally got one of our painters who was smart enough to go to the general and say, "Sir, I've got three different colors here. Would you please choose one?" And sure, I'll figure it. Then from then on, the chief engineer said, "That's not the right color." I said, "Oh, yes, it is, General."
What color did Simmons like? Do you recall?
Buff, I think. I'm not sure. It's sort of buff.
A nice neutral color.
That neutral color. No, I don't think it's probably a little pinkish in it. I don't know. But we had some quite good tradesmen in these units, and they were just delighted to get back at some of their trades and go down and expropriate anything from any paint store. Or I remember even wallpapering some of them.
What sort of priority did engineers have for getting home, or was it a case of priorities? Was that a point system, wasn't it, for the soldiers?
First was all the people who volunteered to go to the Japanese thing, including a lot of people who were so decrepit they couldn't possibly go. They went first. I remember helping the poor sergeant up. He couldn't climb in the back of the truck.
He's so old.
No, he wasn't. He had arthritis or something. But anyway, he obviously wasn't going to go anywhere except home, and that was fine.
So we can understand his thinking. He was just trying to get to Canada.
Oh yeah, sure.
Sure.
And there was a lot of that, and a lot of people who genuinely wanted to do this.
Was the opportunity there for you as an engineer to get to the Tiger Force?
Oh, I could have. I said, I'm in the regular army. I go where I'm told. And I wouldn't volunteer for anything. When I was posted to the occupation force, they said, "Now would you like to change your application to your preference to go to the occupation force?" I said, "No, I don't. If you really want me to volunteer, I'd like to go home, but I will go anywhere you tell me. But stop this nonsense. I joined the army many years ago, and I assumed I was going to do what I'm told. Stop." And at the beginning of the war, I had to volunteer twice, because I volunteered in the wrong piece of paper and stuff. Oh, God. And then you had to check out whether you really did volunteer to go overseas. I said, "God, I'm in the regular force. Of course I go overseas. Stop this nonsense." Anyway, I took the same attitude. It didn't make the slightest bit of difference. I enjoyed the occupation force. I wouldn't have chosen. I would rather have gone home, but was quite fun.
Can I stop there, sir, because I'm just watching and we're going to run out of tape.
Okay.
And perhaps if you'll indulge me again, I'll come back and talk about that little bit and your post-war career.
Okay.